Oh, yeah, rock steady. Aretha Franklin, released in 1971 from the album Young, Gifted, and Black. You know what Detroit needs? It needs its very own Aretha Franklin as mayor. Can you imagine? That'll get Motown moving again. Richard Serrett here on Coast to Coast. You know, once upon a time, a doctor's carried a vial of cannabis oil in their little black bag. Most doctors. It was hailed as a cure-all for many, many ailments. So what happened? What changed? Why the prohibition? And if cannabis oil and cannabinoids are so dangerous, why does the U.S. government hold a patent? We'll get into all of that with a physician, David Casseret, who will join me in mere moments to talk about his book, Stoned, right here on Coast to Coast AM. David Casseret is a physician, author, researcher, and tenured associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. He is the author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, A Doctor Discovers the Surprising Truth About Marijuana. David, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Great, thanks. Good to be here.
I mentioned earlier that once upon a time in America, doctors would carry a vial or a little bottle of cannabis oil in their little black bag. And here we are now, many years later, and I think by last count there are something like 23 states in the union plus the District of Columbia that have passed some sort of law permitting the use of medical marijuana. How did we get to that little vial of cannabis oil in the black bag to prohibition to where we're at now?
It's a great question. Long history. The short answer is cannabis was made illegal in the United States in 1937. The complaint or the criticism of medical marijuana back then that's evolved in more detail over the last 70 or 80 years has been that medical marijuana, it said, has risks of addiction, abuse, and no medical benefit. That's the official position. We're beginning to learn now that although it does have some risks, particularly the risk of addiction, it has a lot more benefits than anybody realized. The challenge, though, is that it's hard to begin to evaluate those benefits. It's hard to understand them. It's hard to do research on them if a substance is illegal. So it's a bit of a catch-22 that once marijuana is declared to be illegal, it's pretty hard to figure out what it can do for people because it's an illegal substance. We're beginning to make some headway there, but it's a challenge and it takes a while.
Earlier, I had Mark Emery on the program, who is sort of dubbed the Prince of Pot. What do you make of his efforts? He would like to see access to marijuana sort of wide open. I mean, do you favor more of a sort of go slow approach? Let's just focus on medical marijuana, or would you like to see an end to prohibition and total legalization?
Well, the book Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, is pretty much what it sounds like. It's a case for medical marijuana. I'm a physician. I'm a palliative care physician. I take care of patients with difficult symptoms, many of whom are near the end of life. And I feel like I have a pretty good sense of how medical marijuana can help my patients. So that's what the book's about. That's my sales pitch, if you will. Beginning to think and hoping getting other people to think about what the risks and benefits of medical marijuana are for that population. It's not that I don't have an opinion about more broad legalization. It's just that's not really what I'm able to comment on. I will say that I think given the medical risks and benefits that I've seen, I think you could make a pretty strong case for legalizing medical marijuana.
Now, you talk about in this book how you essentially experimented on yourself. Elaborate a little bit on that. How did you come to experiment on yourself with marijuana?
Well, as I said before, it's hard to do good research these days. Not impossible. There's some great researchers out there who are doing their best, but it's hard to do good research on a substance that's illegal. And so there are limited numbers of clinical trials. There are some actually quite good ones. But when research data is limited, historically, researchers like myself have turned to research on themselves. And some of the quote-unquote research, I'm not sure I'd dignify it with that term, but some of the experiments, if you will, that I tried, really focused on trying to figure out how to get marijuana or the active ingredients, CBD and THC, into people. And it turns out that ointments and lotions are not a great way of getting those cannabinoids into people, nor are substances like tea and beer and wine. Tried all of those in researching the book. Didn't seem to work particularly well. And in fact, the evidence would back that up as well. The best ways to get cannabinoids into people are the methods that are commonly used. Sometimes edibles, sometimes tinctures, cannabinoids dissolved in alcohol or smoking and vaporizing. Those are really the most reliable methods.
And how are cannabinoids being used in palliative care? Is it primarily to reduce or alleviate end-of-life anxiety or pain management? In what sense?
Yeah, it's a great question. So a lot of the use right now is in some combination of pain, nausea, anxiety, and to some degree, insomnia. Those are some of the most common uses, although that's certainly not an exhaustive list. Some of the best data actually come from using cannabinoids, THC, and increasing interest in CBD actually in managing a particular kind of pain called neuropathic pain. And that's pain that's caused not by a broken bone or an arthritis, but pain that's caused by an injury to the nerve itself. And that kind of pain, that neuropathic pain, could be really, really tough to treat. It doesn't respond as well as other kinds of pain do to opioids like morphine. In fact, many people with neuropathic pain will take opioids and say, well, it helped me a little bit, but it really made me sleepy or it made me nauseated, and I don't like it. And for these people, they're really looking for other forms of relief, of which it turns out that the cannabinoids, THC and CBD and marijuana, seem to be potentially very effective.
And is the one of the active ingredients in cannabis, the THC, is that necessary to be present in cannabis in order for it to to provide this type of relief that you're talking about in palliative care? Is THC necessary?
You know, it may not be. That's been the general sense for years and years and years, that whatever it is in cannabis that makes you feel high also offers benefits. But we're beginning to realize, really in the last 10 or 15 years, that THC may not be as beneficial for management of symptoms as we think it is. And sort of the dark horse in the race, CBD may actually be more beneficial. There are several researchers working in this area, one of whom I spoke with is Barth Wilsey, who is an anesthesiologist and a pain researcher at UC Davis in California. And he's beginning to wonder whether THC may not be as valuable as we've always thought. And some of his clinical trials, mostly on neuropathic pain, are using marijuana that have lower and lower and lower concentrations of THC and higher concentrations of CBD. And he's beginning to think that CBD actually may be quite valuable. And that's really useful because CBD doesn't have any psychoactive effects as far as we know. There have been studies that have involved 300, 400, even 600 milligrams of CBD, which is really a whopping dose. And yet people don't have any of the high feeling that you get with THC.
If you determine that THC isn't necessary, that would stand to reason, then you would eliminate a major political stumbling block in terms of making medical marijuana more available to people. Because I think politicians get hung up on this idea, you're going to smoke it, you're going to get high, you're not going to be productive. if THC isn't present, then it really is just a medicine.
It is. And specifically, THC actually is a medicine. So dronabinol that's sold and marketed under the name Marinol is legal THC. So the FDA has managed to get its head around the idea of selling THC. And I think you're right, CBD, that argument is even easier. The challenge, though, is I think getting legislators and the general public to realize that there are some cannabinoids in marijuana, particularly CBD, that don't get you high. A lot of the parents who were using marijuana extracts for treatment of really nasty seizure disorders in kids, Dravet syndrome, use oils, concentrated oils that are very high in CBD and essentially have no THC. And yet a lot of the publicity around those parents are saying that those parents are using marijuana, they're getting their kids stoned, which is totally not the case. And yet that's the public perception. So I think part of the challenge, you're right, but part of the challenge is making people realize that yes, CBD comes from marijuana, but CBD doesn't have any of those psychoactive effects.
David Kasseret, MD, my guest here on Coast to Coast AM, author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. Was there an aha moment for you, David? Were you at one time a skeptic or a critic of medical marijuana? And then once you delved into this, you did sort of a 180. How did this evolve for you?
Well, I'm not sure I ever began as a skeptic, or maybe I did. It was really a topic that I hadn't thought much about. I knew what I was taught in medical school, which is what most physicians are taught in medical school, which is that marijuana is an illegal drug, period, end of sentence. We really don't get any training, or at least I certainly didn't, about what medical marijuana's benefits might be. One turning point for me was a patient I took care of, a retired English professor who came to me with symptoms related to her advanced cancer, and she asked me whether medical marijuana might help her. And I started to give her the lecture of how medical marijuana is an illegal drug, and there's no research studies to support its use. But she was used to cross-examining her students, and so she cross-examined me, and she said, well, are you sure there are no studies? Have you actually looked? And I said, well, no, actually, I haven't actually looked. I'm just assuming that there aren't. But I promised her I would look into it, and I did, and that's what started me down the road of writing this book, my promise to her that I would actually look for the evidence.
And how many patients have been involved in your studies over the years regarding medical marijuana?
So to be clear, I'm actually not one of these folks who are doing active research in medical marijuana. There are people who do this kind of research, and they do it exceptionally well. People like Barthelsley, who I mentioned, Donald Abrams at UCSF in California, Christine Rabinek. These are all physicians or researchers I've spoken with, as well as Raphael Meshulam in Israel, who's, I think, widely regarded correctly as the grandfather of medical marijuana research, as well as many others. So these people have done very careful, rigorous studies. My focus in writing this book is to get a sense of what they've learned and to try to translate it into a form that all of us can understand. I think it's safe to say that if you add up all the people who have involved in all of their studies, both studies of smoked marijuana, cannabis, as well as studies of either purified or synthetic cannabinoids, you're talking about thousands and thousands of people over the last 30 or 40 years. So it's a fairly large numbers of people in a lot of studies.
And talk to me about where we are at in studying the use of medical marijuana to treat epileptic seizures. I mean, I've seen sort of anecdotally YouTube videos and documentaries and what appears to be, to my eye anyway, a remarkable effect of medical marijuana in alleviating particular childhood seizures. Where are we at in terms of studying this?
Yeah, we're still, I think, in the preliminary stages, and we're relying a lot on anecdotal evidence. To be clear, a lot of the interest is on something called Dravet syndrome, which is caused in kids, usually a year or 2 years old. It's caused by a lesion in something called the SCN1A receptor in the brain that regulates the way that sodium flows into and out of neurons. And this is really a horrible seizure syndrome that comes on when kids are really, really young. Is very, very difficult to treat. One study survey of parents with kids with Dravet syndrome found that they had run through 8, 9, 10, 11 medications trying to find some relief. In the book, I talk about one father of a child with Dravet syndrome who described the syndrome as being, in his words, as fatal as cancer, but harder to treat. So it's really a difficult problem to treat. We don't have a lot of data yet. I describe a conversation with a neurologist named Oren Davinsky, who's in the process now of running a clinical trial. He's the director of the Epilepsy Institute at New York University in New York City, and he's currently enrolling kids in a trial that uses a concentrated form of CBD to see whether that treats seizures. Again, I think everything we have right now is anecdotal, but for a lot of parents who have run through 8, 9, 10 medications for their kids, see their kids declining, seizing often dozens of times a day in front of their eyes, and they can't do anything about it. Many parents, I think, have turned to concentrated cannabis oils out of desperation because, as a scientist, I would say that anecdotal evidence isn't really evidence. But for parents, they rightly say, "Well, that's all we've got. So we're going to take our best shot."
It's true. The medical community tends to look askew at anecdotal evidence. Yet, if I'm a parent with a child that's suffering from multiple seizures, how long am I going to sit and wait for some double-blind study, which is sort of the gold standard? I mean, that could take, 20 years to happen. Why should we make parents wait? Why isn't anecdotal evidence in enough?
It's a question that's haunted research and clinical care for decades. It's actually not that different than what played out in the 80s as AZT, the first major treatment for AIDS, was coming online. There were researchers, scientists who said, "Well, we really need randomized control trials. All we have is preliminary studies of people." And then on the other hand, you had AIDS activists who were saying, "There are hundreds of people dying every week. We understand that all you have is so far is anecdotal studies in people, but you've got anecdotal studies in people. That's enough for us." So who's right? I think the quick summary is that both are right. If you're a bureaucrat at the Food and Drug Administration, your job is to make sure that the public is safe. And the drugs don't get out there unless they have a lot of evidence to back them up. On the other hand, if you're dying of AIDS or if you're a parent of a kid with Dravet syndrome, your job is to make sure that you get the best chance you can. So I don't really know what the right answer is. I think the advantage we have now that we didn't have back in the 80s is that back then the choice was either you make a drug widely available to everybody or you force people to be in randomized control trials. Now we have this option of legalizing medical marijuana. And once that's legal, people can use it. People can use it in trials or outside of trials. There are a lot more options that are available.
All right. Here's Mavis Staples, wrote a song for everyone, taking us into the break. When we come back, more of my conversation with David Kasserit, MD, author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana, right here on Coast to Coast AM. What a beautiful song. For all of those of you who think that the Bee Gees were a disco band based on the soundtrack from Saturday Night Fever, here you go. I started a joke. That song is 47 years old this summer. from their 1968 album called Idea, and a beautiful song, Robin Gibb taking the lead vocal. Of the four brothers, Gibb, Barry, Maurice, Robin, and Andy, only Barry is left, and he's still out there performing. God love him. I will get back to my conversation with Dr. David Kasseret, talking about medical marijuana in just a few moments. Just a reminder, once again, I can't talk enough about paranormaldate.com, and I know I've told you, I'm already taken, not much of a prize, but I'm spoken for. But how I wish paranormal.com was around 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It would have made things so much easier for me because, like you, faithful listeners to Coast, I see the world a little bit differently. You know, I'm interested in things like Bigfoot and UFOs. But if you have that filtering process, something like paranormal.com, that's going to help you find the right match. I mean, why leave things to chance? Why leave it to your wedding night, for example, to discover that your significant other actually believes in the magic bullet theory? That just won't do. Paranormal.com, that's the answer. Check it out now, and it's now available in Canada. Back again with my conversation, Dr. David Kasseret, as we talk about medical marijuana right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you here in Toronto. Dr. David Kasseret, my guest, the author of Stoned, A Doctor's Case for Medical Marijuana. David, no secret that the medical world, a pretty conservative lot. How are you perceived by your colleagues, particularly those who don't subscribe to medical marijuana?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm not sure yet. So Stone will be published in a couple of days, July 14th, and we'll find out then, I guess, what the general public reaction is. I have to say, though, that I've obviously had a lot of conversations with colleagues as I've been working on this book, and the general response has been that some very careful review of the literature and the scientific literature and a balanced view of what the benefits are, what the risks are, how those are balanced, that's something that a lot of my colleagues really, really want, not just for themselves, but want to be able to give their patients. You know, one thing that struck me in all of this medical marijuana debate is that there are a lot of opinions and there's a lot of politics. And I tell several stories in the book of people I've gotten into discussions with who have a lot of very strong opinions about medical marijuana, but really haven't taken the time to talk to researchers, talk to patients, look for scientific studies. And my goal with this book is not to convince people either that medical marijuana should or shouldn't be legal, but to make sure that the people who are espousing those opinions on either side at least have the evidence to back those opinions up. And I've found that for the vast majority of physicians I've talked to, they really, really do want some better understanding of what the evidence is.
And as I mentioned earlier, by last count, 23 states plus the District of Columbia have approved medical marijuana. Do you feel at this time that they're going in the right direction in the United States? Are they going too quickly? Would you like to see them just sort of slow down and wait for more studies? Or are you happy with the progress that medical marijuana is making in the United States?
I think they're on the right track, and I think this progress probably, well, I'm tempted to say this progress and this pace is appropriate, but honestly, it doesn't really matter what I think. I think the horse is out of the barn, and states are moving down the road toward legalization, and nothing you or I or anybody else will do will change that. And I think that's partly because of interest in medical marijuana, but it's also, I think, dissatisfaction with the health system. A lot of the patients I've spoken with have turned to medical marijuana because their healthcare providers or the health system in general is not giving them the time and the symptom management and the sense of control that they really need. So to the degree that this interest in medical marijuana is kind of a referendum on the patient-centeredness of our health system I think medical marijuana will only get more popular. We do definitely need more research, and I think I can't emphasize that enough. We've really been hurt over the last 30 or 40 years because medical marijuana is illegal. If we had been doing randomized controlled trials for the last 30 or 40 years, as we have for other drugs like opioids, we would know a lot right now about how medical marijuana could help patients, and a lot of patients would be benefiting. So there are a lot of patients right now who are losing out because of how difficult it's been to do studies. In
Oh, you
one,
mentioned, sorry, go ahead.
yeah, I was just going to say that to try to jumpstart that process, a group of students at the University of Pennsylvania, where I work, and I got together, designed a website, marijuanaresults.org. That's an opportunity for patients using medical marijuana to share their results. It's a way of sort of jump-starting research, letting patients learn from each other. We actually have a Kickstarter campaign that's just launched a couple of days ago to try to support that website until we get good clinical trial data, giving patients a chance to teach each other and learn from each other.
You had alluded to Israel and their cannabis studies, and I'm not sure if you were referring to the Technion Israel Institute in Haifa, but they do seem to be almost light years ahead of us here in North America in terms of studying the medical benefits of marijuana. And I spoke with Mark Emery earlier about prohibition. How much of the politics involved here in throwing up, obstacles to legalization and approving medical marijuana has to do with the vested interests who benefit from prohibition?
And by that, to clarify, you mean the pharmaceutical industry potentially, or?
Sure, the pharmaceuticals. Let's face it. The prison industry that exists in North America.
Sure. I think all of those are theories that I've heard, and I think there may be some merit to them. Honestly, I think that the biggest driving force that's prevented legalization in the United States is simply fear of addiction and fear of long-term psychiatric effects and other harms that we've inherited from the 50s and 60s. I'm not saying that there may not be other forces involved, but people's reactions when you talk about medical marijuana, when I've talked with people about medical marijuana, are so intense and so visceral. There's this idea that, oh, marijuana is just like heroin. It's almost like talking to people about using crystal meth or crack cocaine as a therapeutic agent. Those who don't laugh at you outright will be offended by that very, very idea. So that seems to me more so than any financial interest, at least from the conversations that I've had. That's really seems to me to drive a lot of people to either just laugh at the idea outright and not take it seriously, or to say that marijuana is evil and bad.
But the age-old argument that it is a gateway drug, where do you weigh in on that?
There's a huge amount of literature on that, scientific literature from a variety of studies. I think the real question to ask is whether, if it's used medically, it will be a gateway drug. And we could argue forever about whether it's a gateway drug for teenagers or for college students. The real question we should be asking is whether, for somebody with PTSD, for instance, or nausea due to chemotherapy, if that person, those people are using medical marijuana, could that become a gateway drug? That's really the question we should be asking now. And it's a fascinating question because we don't really know. Most of the research, virtually all the research that I've seen on risk of addiction and progression to other drugs has been conducted in the use of marijuana for recreational purposes,
And how does a
for
parent,
fun.
for example, a parent with a child who's suffering from severe seizures, multiple seizures every day, how do they weigh the risks? We have multiple studies coming out talking about the link between the use of marijuana and mental illness, things like schizophrenia. How does a parent, you know, weigh those two things in the balance?
Well, honestly, not to be facetious, but, you know, if I were a parent of a 1 or 2 year old who was suffering 20, 30, 40 seizures a day that had failed to respond to a dozen other medications, these seizures have very, very real and potentially fatal consequences for kids. Kids stop breathing during seizures. Seizures by themselves cause, can cause severe cognitive impairment if they're allowed to continue. Any calculation by a parent of risks and benefits has to acknowledge those realities. And I think any theoretical risk of mental illness, and those risks, at least according to my read of the literature, are still pretty theoretical. Any risk of mental illness 20 years down the road compared to watching your child suffering and potentially dying today, I'm not saying that those risks are irrelevant, but most parents, certainly the ones that I've talked to, have said, well, yeah, you know, I understand that, but, you know, my daughter, just in the space of time that we've been talking, you know, for this interview, you know, if my daughter has had 4 seizures in that time, I'm not going to worry about what might happen to her in 20 years from now. I'm going to try to help her right now.
You mentioned a post-traumatic stress syndrome, and Lord knows, you know, that's a huge problem, not just with veterans, but particularly with veterans. It's a huge problem. Talk to me about the use of medical marijuana to alleviate post-traumatic stress syndrome.
It is a huge problem, and both from some research that's been done and a lot of my conversations, that's a really common use, in my opinion, a common reason why people turn to medical marijuana. I tell the story in the book Stoned of a conversation I had with a man who suffered from PTSD, one of many I spoke with, who tried multiple medications, lots of bad toxicity, lots of side effects from all sorts of drugs. And medical marijuana was the first thing that he found that really, really helped him and helped him to avoid a lot of those side effects. So anecdotally, we hear a lot of these stories. There really, to my knowledge, haven't been good randomized controlled trials yet. And that's important because a lot of people, I think, are turning to medical marijuana, and that's one of the areas in which we really, really need to know. I mean, if you have tens of thousands of people potentially turning to medical marijuana to help them from PTSD, we really, really need those clinical trials now. So of all of the areas for which we really, really need research, I think PTSD, for me at least, is at the top of the list.
True or false, the United States government has a patent on cannabis?
That's a good question. The short answer is I don't know. I heard it in the intro, and I made my note to myself to look that up. The government does grow cannabis for use in research purposes. They have a farm down in Mississippi, believe it or not, that that grows cannabis legally for research purposes. I don't know whether the strains that are grown down there are patented. You might know more about that than I do, actually.
I've seen it referenced online where they'll actually mention the patent number. I have it here. It's 6630507B1, which, you know, means nothing. However, it said that they have this patent because they believe that cannabinoids have some antioxidant properties. But it just begs the question if, or it leads to the question rather, you know, if there has been this prohibition against marijuana since 1937, although now it's being eased with medical marijuana, you know, why would the U.S. government have a patent? It seems rather, hypocritical.
Yes, I certainly heard that argument. I don't think there's a lot of debate out there. Maybe I'm being naive, but I don't think there's a lot of debate out there that cannabinoids have medical benefits, whether those are antioxidant benefits. CBD probably has some anti-inflammatory effects. We know that THC has benefits in terms of anti-nausea and pain medication management. So I think the government would agree with that. I mean, again, the FDA has approved dronabinol, which is synthetic THC. So The FDA has agreed that one major component of marijuana, namely THC, has medical properties. So it wouldn't surprise me at all to learn that somewhere deep in the U.S. government there is general acknowledgement that cannabinoids have medical benefits.
Can you talk to me about cannabinoids as a neuroprotectant, in other words, used in the treatment of neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's?
Yeah, so I think those benefits are very, at this point, pretty theoretical. There's some studies that have used synthetic cannabinoids. So, you know, the main cannabinoids in marijuana are THC and CBD and a few others. But there have been probably about 100 cannabinoids with different molecular structures that have been developed in labs. Northwestern University, Clemson University in North Carolina, Hebrew University in Israel, and other places. There's been some studies that some synthetic cannabinoids may reduce the activation of what are called microglial cells in the brain. These are cells that have a variety of functions, ranging from controlling inflammation to serving as kind of the infrastructure around neurons. And that's raised some people to think that by reducing activation of microglial cells, by reducing inflammation, cannabinoids, whether it's THC, CBD, or potentially synthetics, might be protective in the development of Alzheimer's. There have been some other interesting studies of, for instance, CBD after a stroke. One study induced strokes in mice by cutting off blood flow through the cerebral artery and found that using CBD protected brain function and brain structure after that artificially induced stroke. I mean, these are still very, very basic sciencey hypothetical relationships. I don't think we know enough yet. I certainly wouldn't begin treating a stroke, say, with medical marijuana. There are other far more effective drugs out there. But there are a lot of hints like that, that maybe 5, 10, 15 years from now, we might learn something, and some either natural or synthetic cannabinoids might be an effective part of treatment regimens.
These types of long-term studies with human populations, they are very expensive. How can we expect to see these types of studies ever get off the ground? I mean, if Big Pharma isn't involved, who's going to pay for it?
That's, I think, the literally multi-million dollar question. And, you know, many people will have said that that's been one of the rate limiting steps of research so far, that cannabinoids don't have patents, and so Big Pharma doesn't have an interest, and so these studies don't go forward.
Okay, I'm going to cut in here. Excuse me, David. We'll take a time out. We can pick that up on the other end. David Cassaret, my guest, the author of Stoned. We're talking medical marijuana. Raphael Siddiq takes us into the break with Keep On Marching. Back with more of Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett.